You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. On Residue, we tell you the truth behind your favorite movies, and this week we are doing another made-for-TV movie miniseries, Cruel Doubt, starring Blythe Danner and Gwyneth Paltrow. Before we get into it, don't forget you can follow me on Instagram at Residue Podcast, Facebook Residue A True Crime Podcast, and TikTok Residue A True Crime Podcast. And the best thing you could possibly do for any podcast that you love is leave a positive review. Thank you all so much for the positive reviews, and thank you to all of my new followers. And speaking of, do not forget to hit that follow button so you know to meet us back here every single Tuesday. Thank you again for being here with me today, and before we get started, do not forget that listener discretion is always advised. Cruel Doubt is a 1992 true crime television miniseries based on the real 1988 murder of Leith Von Stein in North Carolina and the attempted murder of his wife, Bonnie Von Stein. It was adapted from journalist Joe McGinnis's nonfiction book, Cruel Doubt, which was one of my main sources for today's episode. This miniseries aired on NBC in two parts on May 17th and May 19th, 1992. So the cast is stacked for an early 90s TV movie. We have Blythe Danner as Bonnie Von Stein, and then Gwyneth Paltrow, her real-life daughter, as Angela Pritchard, Matt McGrath as Chris Pritchard, and then we have Ed Asner as attorney Bill Osteen. We also have Dennis Arndt as Leith Von Stein. And the tone of this movie, Cruel Doubt, feels very much like peak early 1990s prestige true crime television. It's got the slow burn pacing. It's got this Southern Gothic atmosphere, courtroom drama, there's psychological family tension. So one of the most controversial things about this made-for-TV movie miniseries was the link to Dungeons & Dragons culture. And they strongly implied that this fantasy gaming, this weapons roleplay, it contributed to the murder. And critics and role-playing game fans, they later argued that this movie unfairly contributed to the 1980s satanic panic atmosphere surrounding Dungeons and Dragons. And some reviewers specifically criticized the film for sensationalizing gaming culture rather than focusing on the actual psychology and greed that was involved in this crime. Reviews for this movie were very mixed because the Los Angeles Times praised the performances, especially Blythe Danner, but criticized this miniseries for being overlong, melodramatic, and some critics actually preferred another TV adaptation of the same case, Honor Thy Mother, which aired only weeks earlier and was based on the competing true crime book by Jerry Bledsoe. So the Leith Von Stein case became the subject of two different books. There was Joe McGinnis's Cruel Doubt and then Jerry Bledsoe's Blood Games, and they were both published in 1991. Now, Bledsoe's book was adapted into the television film Honor Thy Mother. That aired in April 1992, and then McGinnis's Cruel Doubt was adapted into a two-part miniseries of the same name, and that aired in May of 1992. A Letterboxd reviewer writes, "It wouldn't be an early 90s Lifetime movie without some Dungeons and Dragons, satanic panic, fear-mongering, a toxic boy mom who will let her son get away with murder, literally, and a 19-year-old Gwyneth Paltrow brooding hotly in the background." Before bed on July 24th, 1988, Bonnie Von Stein watched a television miniseries about serial killer Ted Bundy. Hours later, she would become the center of a horror story of her own. Monday morning, July 25th, 1988, it is around 4:24 a.m. in Washington, North Carolina. Police receive a 911 call. A woman is whispering, "I've been stabbed. My husband may be dying, and I think I am too." They ask, "What is her name?" And she says, "Bonnie Von Stein." She also tells them, "I don't know where my daughter is, and I don't hear my husband breathing." This woman is speaking so softly, it's almost as if her last breath is almost gone. She tells the 911 operator, "I just hope this is a bad dream." When police arrived at the Von Stein home in the early morning hours, they were met with one of the most horrific crime scenes that they had ever encountered. After forcing open the back door, officers stepped inside and immediately saw blood everywhere. They go upstairs to where the bedrooms were located. In the master bedroom, lying face down on his bed, was Leith Von Stein, and nearby, his wife, Bonnie Von Stein, lay wounded on the floor, and Bonnie was still connected to the 911 call that she had somehow managed to make after this brutal attack. She was barely able to speak. Bonnie had been stabbed and struck in the head over and over with a blunt object. Bonnie is able to ask detectives where her daughter is, and she is telling them, "Please do not let my daughter, Angela, walk into this room." As investigators moved through the house, they make a startling discovery. Bonnie's daughter, Angela Pritchard, is alive. She was asleep in her bedroom, and according to Angela, she heard absolutely nothing during this violent assault. She told detectives she had gone to bed around 11 p.m. with a fan running in her room, a box fan, and she slept through the entire attack. Yet officers noted how quickly she woke the moment they entered her room. She was calm and composed, and Angela showed little outward panic as police secured the house around her. Detectives are a little suspicious of Angela right off the bat because she didn't really act panicked. And she also had this water glass next to her bed full of ice. And she said she went to bed at 11 p.m., never woke up, never heard anything. So they were wondering how this ice wasn't melted. I mean, they're saying that she went to bed at 11 p.m. It's now 5 in the morning and the ice is still there. So they're a little suspicious, although they don't take any photos of this at the crime scene. They also notice that the back door that they came in, the window is busted out, but it's busted out from the inside. Like, there's more glass on the lawn than there is inside of the house, which means somebody broke this window from the inside. Angela is taken downstairs. Bonnie, her mother, is rushed to the hospital. Police are talking to Angela, and they're realizing, I mean, this is one of the bloodiest crime scenes they've ever witnessed. Leith Von Stein was hit about 20 times with a baseball bat, and he had 7 stab wounds on his back, and they just find it unfathomable that Angela didn't hear one sound. So detectives let Angela make a couple phone calls, and she immediately calls one of her friends named Andrew Arnold, and she wants him to rush over to the house, which he does. The second call she makes is to her brother, Chris, who is away at college in Raleigh, North Carolina. Now, detectives wrote down in their notes that Angela was not curious at all as to what happened. She didn't ask any questions. She didn't ask what happened to her mother, what happened to her stepfather. Police wanted her to go down to the station, and she agreed. She put a pair of jeans on, but she left the house barefoot. When Bonnie arrives at the hospital, she pulls through and she is ready to talk.
to detectives. So they go to the hospital and they start asking her questions, but Bonnie couldn't identify her attacker. She said she couldn't tell if the person was male, female. All she knows is that she woke up, she saw this person standing above her and swinging a baseball bat at her. Investigators just could not ignore the fact that there were too many troubling questions. Leith von Stein had been brutally attacked. He absorbed the worst of this attack. Beaten over and over with a baseball bat, stabbed multiple times, while Bonnie, even though she was critically injured, she survived. That on top of the fact that Angela is saying she heard absolutely nothing, and then downstairs the window is broken from the inside, some of these detectives start wondering whether this meant something more. Bonnie herself had been stabbed in the chest, struck in the head. These were injuries that were severe enough to kill her, but in the back of their minds, this question lingered that there is the possibility this attack could have been staged to make her look like a victim too, and if so, for what reason? As police dig deeper into the family dynamic, they're uncovering this growing tension inside of the von Stein household. This is mostly between Leith and Bonnie's son, Chris Pritchard. So while investigators worked the crime scene in Washington, Angela managed to reach her brother Chris at North Carolina State University in Raleigh sometime around 5 in the morning. And at first, no one answered the phone in dorm room 611B, but when Chris finally picked up, he fell apart. He was described as throwing things around the room, acting frantic, screaming that he could not find his car keys. He was very panicked, and he just ran out of the dorm room, and he found campus police officers telling them that his parents had been stabbed, and he needed a ride home immediately because he cannot find his car keys. So campus police did drive Chris back the 2 hours to Washington, and he was so exhausted and emotionally drained. I mean, Chris was up the night before until about 3 in the morning, just playing cards, playing Dungeons and Dragons with his roommates, with his friends at college. They were getting really drunk. When Chris ran out of his dorm room, he was still wearing the clothes that he wore the night before. So he passed out in the back seat of the police car the entire way home. By the time they arrived back to Chris's home, it was around 8 in the morning. Chris arrives to the house and he sees his sister Angela just sitting at the neighbor's house across the street in the grass with a bunch of friends around her, and they're smoking. Chris runs up to his sister and Angela tells him Leith has been murdered. Mom is in the hospital, and Chris rushes to the hospital to be by his mother's side, and he stayed by Bonnie's bedside crying. As investigators are watching this unfold and trying to figure out what the hell happened, first, they need to figure out who are Bonnie and Leith von Stein. Well, Bonnie used to be Bonnie Bates, and she was married to a man named Steve Pritchard. Now, with Steve, she had her two children, Chris Pritchard and Angela Pritchard, Leith's new stepkids. So, very early after Angela was born, Steve leaves the family, and now Bonnie's on her own. She's struggling. Bonnie packs up the kids, moves in to her family's home on a farm in Lexington, North Carolina, and Bonnie goes back to school and she studies computers. She takes a job in data processing in Winston-Salem in 1974, and while working there, she meets a man named Leith von Stein. Now, Leith ran that data processing department. Leith's parents were very successful. They had a successful dry cleaning business, and they called this Camel City Cleaners. And Bonnie's parents quickly fell in love with Leith. He just felt like he was a perfect match for their daughter. Bonnie married Leith in 1978, and after the wedding, their new little family moved to South Bend, Indiana. And the family lived in Indiana for about 2 years before Leith was laid off from his finance job. After he was laid off, he received a job offer in 1981 for a company called National Spinning. And this was going to be a great job. Like, it paid very well for that time. And Leith knew that he was going to have to move his family. He can't say no to this job offer. He's got Bonnie, Angela, and Chris to take care of. So they pack up and they move to Washington, North Carolina, where Leith takes this new amazing job for National Spinning Company. At the time of this move, Chris was 12 years old, Angela was 11, and they knew that this move was going to bring their family a really stable life. But Leith never grew to like this town. Leith and Bonnie were not social people. They were not sociable. They were said to be very private, and they were fairly unknown to most of their community, and nobody in the neighborhood really ever got to know these two. As Chris enters high school, Leith's parents pass away. Leith was born in 1946, and he was the only child of Howard and Marie von Stein. And as I said, his family owned this very highly successful dry cleaning business. Leith served in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War era, and he transitioned into computer programming in the 1970s and became an expert in data processing. Now, when he met Bonnie, he treated her children as his own. Leith never had any children of his own. And now Leith's parents pass away, and he is left over $1 million inheritance. And this significantly boosted his net worth. And he knew he wanted to take care of Bonnie's children. So he wrote them into his will. Leith adjusted his will because he wanted to make sure that Chris and Angela would be provided for in the future. Leith was the type of person that he just did not tolerate people who didn't try their best. And since he didn't have kids of his own, he really wanted to bond with his stepkids. And now Chris is about to graduate high school. He's going to go off to college in Raleigh, North Carolina. And Leith wants to teach him the importance of persistence, education, and hard work. He's not going to tolerate Chris just taking a free ride. So he does pay for Chris's education, but he's telling him, you better keep the grades up and you better work hard. Leith isn't just a hard ass, though. He actually buys Chris a 1965 Ford Mustang. And in that 65 Ford Mustang, Chris drives off to Raleigh, North Carolina to attend North Carolina State University, and he meets his new group of friends who are very into playing Dungeons and Dragons and taking LSD. And Chris doesn't give a shit about school. Chris starts failing miserably. He's not attending classes. He is just constantly partying. I mean, he barely makes it through his first semester. And of course, Bonnie and Leith are really upset. They're pissed off because they're paying for all of this. And Chris is just out here partying his ass off, not giving a damn about the fact that they're putting up all of this money for him to get an education. So he's failing, Leith is paying, and Leith is pissed. He's just sick of Chris slacking off. He's reached his boiling point. And now Bonnie is stuck in the middle because she is like, oh my God, but he's my son. You know, she doesn't want Leith and Chris to be fighting constantly. And at the same exact time, Angela is not being a little angel over here. Leith wasn't accepting of any of the boys that Angela started dating. Angela was very into boys. I mean, she was your typical teenage girl. She wanted to be with her friends. She wanted to be hanging out all the time. And she started seeing some boys that Leith didn't approve of. Now you can imagine the tension in the house. Leith is upset. He's paying for everything. Bonnie doesn't like him, yelling at her kids. But at this time, Leith is paying for Chris's entire college education, and he believes that Chris is just lazy and selfish, and that Chris is tearing this family apart in Leith's eyes. But Bonnie just wants him to lay off of her kids. It had to be so tense in that home. Now, Chris is home from college. He has absolutely no responsibilities. He's just wasting his time, and he's wasting Leith's money. And Leith starts to feel like Angela and Chris are just very spoiled. And he gets into a shouting match with Chris, and they yell back at him the type of shit like, you're not even my real dad. You can't tell me what to do. But it gets to a point where Chris says, okay, listen, I'm going to try harder. And Leith says, I will pay for you to go to summer school before fall semester starts if you agree that you're going to really work at this and really get your grades up. So he's got this second chance. But while the fall semester starts, Angela goes to visit Chris on campus, and she sees that he's not really working that hard. He's partying. He's doing drugs. He's drinking. He's playing a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. And again, he is failing, completely failing every single class. And Leith gives him an ultimatum. If your grades aren't raised, I'll pull the money. There's no more college. There's no more partying in your dorm room with your Dungeons and Dragons friends. There's no money. There's no college because you won't get your grades up. And Chris again begs for forgiveness and promises that he's going to be better. He's really going to try his hardest. Now, detectives have uncovered all of this turmoil within the household. Now, Leith has been murdered. Bonnie is just getting home from the hospital. Detectives go and visit Chris at school, and Chris tells them, listen, I can't provide you any information about this murder. He says, the night of the murder, I was with my friends at school in my dorm room. We were partying. We stayed up till 3 a.m. We played cards, and there was absolutely no way that I could have driven home to commit this murder. And that's true. His alibi checks out. Chris Pritchard is cleared of the actual murder, and there are no leads. And police are getting some backlash from the residents of the neighborhood because this case is unsolved. And they're thinking, if somebody could break in to their home, to the Von Stein home, then what's going to happen to all of us? Could they carry out this savage attack again? Who's going to be next? And then the investigators finally received a break. A local farmer working near the roadside of his property noticed smoke rising from a small burning pile, and this was located on the edge of the road. So something about it seemed strange, so he called the police. And when detectives arrived, they found this charred patch of ground barely 2 feet wide. This was evidence that someone had tried to destroy something in a hurry. So they sift carefully through the ashes, and the investigators recovered several partially burned items, including clothing, scraps of paper, and a knife that appeared consistent with the wounds inflicted during the attack on the Von Steins. So the most important discovery came from a crumpled piece of paper that survived this fire. And once it was at the crime lab, the technicians reconstructed the paper, and detectives realized it was a hand-drawn map of the Von Stein neighborhood. And the family street name had been written clearly across the page, and marked over the Von Stein home was a large X. Detectives still think that Chris Pritchard has something to do with this, so they need to figure out how to tie this handwritten map to Chris. So they go to his college, and they find a copy of his dorm registration, and this was a handwritten registration. So they compare the handwriting, and it is a match. Chris is the mastermind, but his alibi checks out, so if he did not commit this murder, then who did? Well, two suspects quickly emerge. They are James Upchurch and Neil Henderson. These three met at North Carolina State while they partied together and played Dungeons and Dragons. And Dad will let you know right now that the first one to crack was Neil Henderson. Neil was the most intelligent of the three, detectives would say. He had a really good head on his shoulder, and almost everyone they spoke to could not believe that Neil could have gotten himself into this mess. Everyone who knew him said that he was destined for success. Neil breaks down and he lays out for detectives exactly what happened. On Wednesday, July 20th, 1988, while Chris was attending summer school that Leith paid for, Chris and Neil discussed the subject of what would happen if Chris's parents were dead. Like, how much money was he going to get in this inheritance if his parents were gone? Now, this night when these boys are discussing this, James and Neil don't believe that Chris is being serious. They're thinking this is just some big joke and they're bonding over this, which is just absolutely insane. But Chris tells them, listen, if my parents were gone and I had all of this money, I would help you open a restaurant. I would buy you both fine cars. But the very next day, Chris starts talking about it again, and this time they took it seriously. So they start coming up with all of these plans, and Chris tells them, maybe we can start a fuse box fire at the home, or maybe we can put crushed sleeping pills in their food so they'll sleep through the fire. I mean, these three are now legit coming up with plans and ways to kill this entire family. And at one point, one of the boys asks Chris, like, well, what do we do about Angela? What if she's at the house and she's in the house at the same time that they're there and we try to set the house on fire? What do we do about her? And Chris said, well, if she is there, then I guess her too. But if she's not there, then that's fine too. So Chris didn't give a shit about his sister at all. So according to the plan, on Friday, July 22nd, Chris would drive home. And then on Saturday morning, he told his parents he was leaving to go see some friends. But what he was really doing was driving back to Raleigh to pick up James Upchurch. And then once in Raleigh, James Upchurch gave Chris a package of crushed sleeping pills. Now, the two of them drive back to Washington that afternoon. And then Chris drops off James Upchurch at a location far away from the house where he was to wait until Chris returned. Now, Chris goes home and prepares hamburgers for his entire family, and he laces those hamburgers with sleeping pills. After the family eats Chris's drugged up hamburgers, Chris tells his family, I'm going to go back to college. I'll see you guys later. And then after he leaves his parents' home, Chris drives back to where James Upchurch was staying. And then the two of them unsuccessfully try to crush a fuse. This doesn't work. They couldn't pull it off. James Upchurch is like, this is not something that we're going to be able to do, so let's scratch this. And now they have a new plan. And the new plan is, we're going to buy a machete from the Army surplus store, and we're going to chop everyone's head off. But the Army surplus store, it wasn't open that day. So now that plan is scratched too. The very next morning, they drive to Kmart and they buy a knife, a hunting knife. This new plan involved Neil Henderson driving James Upchurch to Washington while Chris stayed in Raleigh at his dorm room. And this was so that he could establish his alibi. Neil Henderson needed to drive Chris's 1965 Mustang, that, by the way, was gifted to him by his stepfather, Leith, because James Upchurch didn't have a driver's license. So if James was driving Chris Pritchard's Mustang and police stopped him and he got stopped because he didn't have a driver's license, they would find out that this car is connected to Chris. So they have Neil drive the car and drive James to Washington. It's a very ridiculous plan. Chris drew a floor plan of his home for James Upchurch and a map of his neighborhood. He tells the boys, listen, if you help me pull this off, you're each going to receive $50,000. I'll buy James Upchurch, the man with no license, a Porsche. And for Neil Henderson, I will gift you a Ferrari. The plan is James goes into the home. He breaks in, makes it look like a robbery. He kills all three of them with the knife and the baseball bat. And then Chris even told James where he could find his mother's purse, so maybe he could steal some money out of that, make it look even more like a robbery. And Neil would be waiting in the getaway car. On Sunday night, July 24th, Neil Henderson arrived at the Raleigh campus parking lot where he met James Upchurch. And James got into his vehicle with a green backpack, a baseball bat, black tennis shoes, and dark clothing, which included a ski mask. The two drive to Washington. They arrive around 2:30 a.m. They locate the Von Stein house, and then they drive around for a little bit. This is when James tells Neil to park the car, and then James gets out, heads towards the house, and says, I will be back in 30 minutes. James entered the home through a back door with a key that Chris gave him, and he went straight up to the master bedroom where Leith and Bonnie were asleep. James hit Leith with the baseball bat, and Bonnie woke up. Bonnie was awakened by the sound of her husband's screams, and there was a lot of confusion. She said that she was aware that there was somebody standing at the foot of her bed, but she couldn't make out who it was. And as I said in the beginning, she couldn't tell if they were male or female. Her husband was making short, piercing screams, and she tried to reach out her hand to her husband, but when she did, she was struck by the weapon, and that fractured her thumb. And she is listening to her husband continue to scream, and the intruder starts striking her. So she saw her husband being hit with a weapon, and she was struck so much in the head that she just loses consciousness while this is all happening. She momentarily wakes up, and that's when she again sees this intruder standing near her feet, and this person strikes her with an object as she's just laying there on the floor. She also remembers hearing these thumps and whooshes through the wall. That was causing her to believe that her daughter was also being attacked. And then she falls back out of consciousness again. And then she wakes up again, and this time she is aware that she's on the floor. So she reaches for the bed and she tries to feel for her husband. She feels his fingers. They were limp, but she thought she heard him breathing. And she realized that she is very injured herself. She must get help. And she's able to crawl and push herself towards the telephone in their bedroom and call 911. Now, James panicked. That's why he did not, quote, finish off Bonnie like all the detectives were wondering about. It was because he didn't realize how hard it was going to be to kill someone. And he's stabbing Leith. He's hitting Leith. And he had no energy left. And he started panicking. He still had to make this look like it was a break-in. So he hit Bonnie and he stabbed Bonnie in the chest. And he figured, she's going to die. I have to leave. I have to get out of here. But what about Angela? He didn't want to hurt Angela, so he didn't even go near her room. After Neil confesses all of this to detectives, James, Neil, and Chris are all arrested. But since Neil cooperated, Neil was going to get a plea deal. He would receive 40 years for testifying against these two, and Neil Henderson was released after serving 10 years. James Upchurch denied all charges, and he was found guilty of first-degree murder, assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill or seriously injure, conspiracy to commit murder, and burglary in the first degree. And he was sentenced to death. But James Upchurch was resentenced on October 1st, 1992, to life in prison with the possibility of parole. Now, Chris Pritchard was convicted of aiding and abetting in second-degree murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison. On top of that sentence, Chris was also sentenced to 20 years for aiding and abetting the assault on his mother, Bonnie Von Stein. And I will let you know that Chris Pritchard was paroled on June 2nd, 2007. And later, he became a born-again Christian. Bonnie Von Stein forgave her son. She forgave him for the murder of his stepfather, of her husband, Leith Von Stein, and the attack on her. I mean, she publicly supported her son, stating that she believed drug addiction and peer influence played a major role in his actions, and she ultimately forgave him, and the two reconciled. And after Chris was released on parole in 2007, these two maintained a very close relationship. When Chris was released from prison in 2007, he did an interview with Fox 8 News, and he told them that it took me years to get my head screwed on straight. I have done an appropriate amount of time, and that's my view of it. He said that he is a much different man from the 19-year-old who plotted to kill his stepdad and his mom in an effort to inherit a $2 million estate. Bonnie stated that she has forgiven her son for his part in this crime. I have visited with Chris for a long, long time in prison. I've watched him grow. I've watched him change. Chris was living with his mother, Bonnie, at the time of this interview, and he said that he was working with at-risk youth, and this was something that he hoped to continue doing. Chris told reporters, "I'm going to be honest with you now. After I committed the crime and the reality of what I did had actually set in, I really, really felt like I was living in a fantasy world. When you do wrong, you're supposed to be punished. That's the bottom line. That's how it works. It took me years to get my head screwed on straight, and I have done an appropriate amount of time. That's my view of it." Thank you so much for being here with me today. Do not forget to hit that follow button so you can join me back here next week. And until then, stay safe and stay paranoid. Residue is created, hosted, written, researched, edited, and produced by me, Chrissy. Residue crew forever.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.